Hello and welcome to episode 55 of Formatted to Fit Your Screen, the show where two people who have seen a movie have a conversation. I'm your host, Zach Tennant, and wow, episode 55, double nickels. This is very exciting stuff. And on this episode, I am joined by interdisciplinary artist Lenore Claire Harum for a discussion of a cult movie that I think also has a cult against it as well, I feel, kind of, from the year 1985. We were dealing with Clue, written and directed by Jonathan Lynn, of course, based off the popular board game that we all know from lake houses and, I want to say, dentist office waiting rooms everywhere. This is an episode that was put together by a mutual friend of Lenore and I, an old friend from high school, Yonina Rolick, who suggested that we get together for this Clue episode, and it was a real treat to talk to Lenore about this movie that I feel like the best episodes of this show are when, you know, someone else you find that you have the exact same history with, just some weird kind of obscure movie. I feel like the Stealing Harvard episode of this show is another example of that. So it was a lot of fun talking to Lenore about this this kind of staple of weird theater kid childhoods, and I feel like a lot of the people I've met as we get into in this episode kind of have a similar relationship to the movie. And if you'd like to keep up to date with Lenore's work, you can follow precious_period_puppies on Instagram to see updates about season 2, which is forthcoming. I'll be back at the end of the episode to let you know who's joining me in 2 weeks' time, but for now, please enjoy 1985's Clue with Lenore Claire Harum.
Tuesday on City, we've got a world premiere great movie. We just don't know where it is.
It stars Tim Matson. Remember him from Animal House? He was one of those guys!
And Tracy Pollan, my ex. And now she's crazy. And I can't find her anyplace.
We'd show you all the exciting highlights, but we haven't got any.
All right, so we are here today with interdisciplinary artist Lenore Claire Harum. And we are talking about, from 1985, the film Clue, written and directed by Jonathan Lynn. Lenore, thanks for being on the show today.
Hi, thanks for having me, Zach.
This was an episode that was suggested, the topic and the guest, by a mutual friend of ours, Yonina Rolick. Shout out to Yonina. I'm just curious to know a little bit about your history with the movie and what it is about Clue that has made an impact on you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Zach. And thanks, Yonina, as well, for the putting us together. So
it's the power of podcasting.
It's the power of podcasting, exactly. So yeah, it's funny. My history with Clue is kind of intense. I remember my first engagement with it was I was about 10 years old, and we had cable. One of those cables you could see what was on which channel later in the day by like looking through the menu kind of thing.
Very futuristic at the time.
It was like TV Guide, but with a remote. So very fancy. But still, either internet wasn't really, I didn't think to look up what this was. Anyway, I saw it was on about 6 hours later from the time I saw it. And I was like, Clue, could that possibly be the board game? I love the board game. And it was just one of those feelings where you are just like, you'll remember it forever. And the excitement inside of me was so intense. And I just knew that I had to sit in front of the TV and wait for it to turn on. And I did. And I was just glued to it. And it became this moment I still remember forever. And then, also, at that time, we went to the library to get movies. J.S. Wood, hashtag, shout out.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I would go to J.S. Wood Library, I would look it up, but there was no Clue, only Clueless, which is also a good movie.
Yes, also.
So I watched it front to back when I was like, yeah, 10 years old. And then that was all I ever got of it. And I was like, this fleeting moment where this insane movie was on TV. Until like a few years later, maybe 13 or 14, we were at A&B Sound, that store that I think is out of business now, but it used to sell CDs and movies. My dad loved it. And we found it there. And I was pissing myself with excitement. And so my dad bought it for me. And I watched it nonstop. So it was my favorite movie. In fact, the first play I wrote and directed when I was like 15 for Floyd Festival. Shout out to Floyd Festival at the Refinery. The play I wrote called Homicide 101 was very much based on this movie. The plot was a little different. All of these people in this old crotchety man's will are invited for a dinner party and they all try killing him off, but their murder plans fail, so they kill each other off by accident. And it's not the same, but it was so inspired. All to say, this movie has really shaped the way I create art, and it just has everything buckled into what I love about films through humor, aesthetic, camp, and absurdity.
Yeah, hearing you say that, I feel like we're on such similar ground, and I'm excited to dig into it. That what I remember about this movie, when I was younger, I subscribed to a magazine that's definitely not in print anymore. I think it went by a few different names, but it was, for a time, it was the magazine Not for Adults, and then they kind of dropped the Not for Adults thing, and it was just called The Magazine. Nice. It was like a Canadian youth, sort of like a companion to something like Owl magazine, but they had a little bit more edge and they put out like 100 movies you need to see in one of their big issues. And I made it a big point to see a lot of the movies that were in there. And I still remember which ones they were, like Uncle Buck, The Cable Guy, It, the Tim Curry It, which is,
yes,
which is so not for kids, but it's like, it was the magazine not for adults, but like, it was a magazine for like 10-year-olds. And it was like, really see this. It's like, who's making this magazine? But
yeah, It was my first scary movie that is burned in as the one that scares me. But it's funny.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I was just talking about this recently. It's funny how you can't really try to be in cult movies, but if there is an award for being in the most cult movies, Tim Curry might get the part.
Oh, for sure. Like Tim Curry. Yeah. We did Rocky Horror on this podcast a long time ago.
Yeah.
Tim Curry, just one of the finest like ham actors that ever was, just so deliciously like evil and kind of sinister, but delightfully funny all the time.
Yeah.
So terrific in this movie. Yeah. But yeah, Clue was in this, in the magazine recommending it, that it was, you know, such a good movie and, you know, a movie based on the board game, could it be good? And I think that's also interesting now that we live in such an age where everything is based off of an IP, you know, there's a Mario movie in theaters right now based on a video game. There's a movie about the Nike shoe, you know, it's all just film about commerce and about product and about things that people know.
Totally.
From the real world being sort of like repackaged and sold to them in the movie format. But that was a lot rarer in 1985. This movie was something very new and different, which I think now it's such a tired, played out thing. But it is something that in like 2004, there hadn't really been anything like it since then. It's not like there was a Monopoly movie in the 90s or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
But it did. There wasn't a copy at the J.S. Wood Library. I'm glad that you are in the library system, because I had to see this movie by renting it from 49 Cent Video.
Oh, yes. They would have it.
Had to call around town and figure out where they had it. And I remember I was flipping back and forth on whether I wanted to tell this story or not, but I will.
Yeah.
That the night, I think it might have been Easter weekend or something. No, probably not that, but it was, we had a 3-day weekend because of parent teacher interviews. And so we were renting a movie on a Thursday night, and I was going to get to stay up late on a Thursday night and not have school the next day and watch a movie. And then my mom went to parent teacher interviews, and I guess the teacher said that I say things that I shouldn't, or that I don't know. I don't really remember what grade I was even in. I don't remember what teacher it was.
Yeah.
But I remember being like, take it easy. I mean, like, I don't think I was the problem in that situation.
Yeah.
But then I watched Clue, which has some like innuendo and like, you know, whatever adult kind of content in it. But the singing telegram scene where the woman gets shot, my mom like walked in the room and is like, so is that like something you would like tell your classmates about that that happened in the movie? And like trying to like suss out. Ugh. Like I said, I really didn't want to tell that story, but I did. So.
Ba-da-ba-da-ba-ba.
Yeah. But yeah, like, and it's had an influence on me as well in the, like, I did a short film when I was in high school that involved someone getting killed by a smashing chandelier. Certainly not the most novel concept, but something that stood out to me watching Clue this time around as being like, well, that's definitely something I had seen a trillion times already by that point.
Yep. And in fact, the chandelier doesn't even kill anyone. It almost does multiple times. It's a red herring, though, you know? Yeah.
Well, this movie is quite a bit about red herrings. So
red herrings, yeah.
The premise of the movie, I guess we should lay it out, that if anyone has ever played the popular board game, you know, this movie is the logical extension of that. It's a murder mystery set in a house. Contained location, small cast. We have a lot of comedy all-stars basically from supporting roles in movies such as Tim Curry and Madeline Kahn. And then we have people who are on TV at this time, like Christopher Lloyd from Taxi, kind of pre Back to the Future fame in this movie, although Back to the Future came out the summer of this, of 1985, just before Clue. Didn't help it out that much, but and then Michael McKean, who had been on Laverne and Shirley and more recently was on Better Call Saul. But a comedy, you know, a good solid cast coming together to bring personality to what are quite literally one-dimensional characters. Like, what do you know about Clue, the board game, beyond that you've played it in your life? Does it really have a place in your life?
Well, I mean, I love it as a, it's always been my favorite board game. I know that it was originally called Cluedle. I'm pretty sure that's a fact. It has a bunch of different, I love the different aesthetic variations that have happened throughout the decades. You can get the different aesthetics with, yeah, I just love everything about it.
Well, do you associate the characters with personalities?
Absolutely. That,
does it connect to this movie though? Or do you see personalities in them? Cause it's so hard to separate when you've seen the movie so many times at this point.
Yeah.
And it makes the game funner to have this added personality.
Yes. So I think, before the movie, when you're just looking at the board game box covers and the different characters that are portrayed there, I'd say for the most part, it lines up. I think the biggest difference for me is Mrs. White, because in the movie, she's this femme fatale, like Black Widow, seductress. Well, Miss Scarlet is also a seductress, but she's the Black Widow stuff. And I think in the board games, you kind of see her as more as a frumpy maid, Mrs. Teapot sort of thing. but in this, she is a Black Widow viper. And even the first, I remember the first time watching it, I was like, oh, are they all going to be wearing their colors? And I was a little disappointed, but they all do have like a hint. For example, when Mrs. White first takes off her coat, she's wearing all black as a Black Widow would, but when she takes off her coat, her entrance scene, you see like the white silk interior. And then there's this like harp music that's like, and then Miss Scarlet isn't in red, she's in green. And I was like, the complimentary will do. And then Mrs. Peacock, she's not in blue. However, she is adorned in peacock feathers. So there are hints, which I appreciate. And then the men, I did then and today now care much less about men's fashion. But there are still hints, like Professor Plum, I don't think he's wearing a purple suit to my memory, but I think this Colonel Mustard is sort of wearing at least a Dijon sort of color. And yeah, Mr. Professor Plum, he's like a studious, as I used to think. And I like how they made Colonel Mustard a little bit stupid. He's kind of the dunce. But in the, and whenever I want to play Colonel Mustard, I pictured him a little bit gruff. I think on one of the boxes, he looks like he's just come from a safari in Africa or something with one of those big mustaches. He's just shot a lion.
Yeah, I feel like in the movie, he's depicted as like a World War II veteran kind of guy. But then I'm thinking of the board game, or I'm also thinking of the like computer game that would come with cereal boxes when we were growing up. He's much more of like, he's like fighting the Boer War, like down in Africa, like killing lions or something like that. He's got a shady past, Colonel Mustard.
Yes, I loved that cereal box, CD-ROM computer game. Change like that. I would also just play nonstop. Damn, I want that to that to happen again.
Something that I found though was that it's a great movie because the actors who have distinct comedic personalities, they bring that to what are mostly like flat game piece characters, and then the dynamic and the rhythm of what makes the movie work and the magic of it is that you have a great cast. And it's not a TV show cast where you got, a string of episodes with these people. Like I was kind of thinking of Arrested Development a little bit upon this viewing of like, how often do you have this many really funny people together on screen together, reacting to each other? You see them listening and you see them do little bits of acting, but it's not a TV series or even a series of movies. It's just this one contained little movie, which then also happens to be a remake of a board game. It just makes it's just such a nice combination, isn't it?
It really is. And like, speaking of the actors, Leslie Ann Warren, I think,
as Scarlett,
I just fell absolutely in love with her.
This movie has a lot of sex appeal, doesn't it? And like I thought that as a kid, and I still think it to this day. Like it's for just like a, you know, kind of fun campy comedy, it's the people look good in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Eileen Brannon, she is also in this other movie that's so much similar to Clue, I find, in terms of vibe. It's called Murder by Death. And it's from 76. And I sometimes wonder how much inspiration, because as far as I can tell, they're pretty unrelated, besides that Eileen Brannon is in it and the decade difference. But if you love Clue, this is me giving you that recommendation, Murder by Death.
Yeah, I've seen that on TV in the past, and it didn't have the sticking power with me that Clue did, but it is like, it feels like a run.
Yeah.
The same kind of material, but it is like this murder mystery comedy is such a, it's one of the ultimate genres that there is, or one of the, you know, things as old as time is like a big mansion house with a murder in it. You know, obviously we've had the Knives Out movies in the last few years here.
Yeah.
Heavily indebted to this same sort of thing.
Totally. But they kind of stepped it up.
Well, that was a noted difference that I found in watching the movie this time, was that whereas Knives Out has an implausible but pretty neatly tied together, I'm thinking more of the first one because I fell asleep during this most recent One Glass Onion. I don't know that one as well. But the first one, it was like a tightly constructed mystery that has you at different points going like, wow, I didn't see that coming. And oh my God, I can't believe, oh, holy crow. And it's totally, it works on that level. Whereas like this movie, it's so convoluted. If you try to follow it, I don't think you can. I've never actually really tried to follow it. And then that's borne out by the fact that it has three different endings. That all, like, how tight of a thing can it be if it's so open-ended?
Yes.
That there's room for everyone else to still be like culpable. So it's not a mystery at all. It's just a comedy subversion.
Totally.
That's kind of what I like too, that it doesn't come to any kind of a conclusion that makes sense to you. It's just a joke. It's a comedy machine that runs basically until it stops having jokes.
Yeah.
Cuts off and ends, and then you're left with a nice, short, funny movie.
Well, okay. Speaking of those three different endings, and another note, like, you know, of these things in your life that are introduced and ingrained when you're a kid, and then they stay in your life and you just discover something new, or you're like, oh my God, of course. I was discussing Clue with a friend who it's also a big time favorite. And I realized the three different endings. I'm like, oh, I've always been, that's such a cute thing. Of course it's the three different endings, because in Clue, when you're playing the game, every time you play, it's, you don't know who did it. It's a different ending. And I'm like, that's why they did that. I thought it was just a cute, creative, unique gimmick, until I realized that. And then on top of that, like the aesthetic at the end where they're all running through each room to, so we can see where they went and how they did it. Well, that's an homage to playing the actual game when you're trying to roll the dice and hit the marks and get around the whole building. So all the pieces are literally running through each room.
And like, I believe the secret passageways as well in the movie correspond exactly with the ones that are in the board game. Yeah,
they are. So it's just these little details that you're like, oh my gosh, you realize decades later.
This movie, does it feel to you like it really works as a movie or as like a really funny acting piece? Because so much of it is, it's, you know, the costumes are great, but that's not unique to film. Like, it feels so much like a theater piece that you're just kind of seeing on camera. And I feel like I've seen these kinds of because it is, it's like, it's sort of campy theatricality of it. Like, this is the bread and butter of like community theater groups. I feel like I've seen it, like Persephone Theater. I've seen these kinds of things 100 times over, and they go over so well with crowds because they love this kind of like frothy door slamming comedy. But if you don't if you don't like that, and if you don't like plays, is this a boring movie? Does it not work as a movie on terms other than that?
That is a great question. Something I haven't considered before, because I am a much more theater play, I love community theater person. And I enjoy movies, but I'm not one to, well, I wouldn't be one to consider that. But I think that you have definitely have a point there. And the people who also love this movie in my life are all theater kids. So yes, I would agree with you.
And it, like, I think there's a benefit to, you know, everyone has a different relationship with like how they feel about movie stars, but some people don't care if it looks like a cast is having fun doing something. But like, and
that's the most important thing to me a lot of the time. You know,
that's the thing. Yeah. Like, and that's what you get in a play, is the idea that they're like, they're really playing, having like a magnetic connection with each other. Yeah, it's not cut together. It's chemistry right there in front of you.
Exactly.
And then it's got a very good score to it. Definitely like a campy, you know, derivative kind of score, but an effective one, a fun one.
I love it. It's in my head all the time. Like that opening. The opening music. The first time I watched it, and the opening music with like the storm and the castle and the cars pulling in, like I still remember the shivers I got, and I'm getting them now. It's like so special.
It really, it gears you up for the movie, and like that's the role of us. It sets the mood, it gets you in the mindset, it gets you ready for it.
And then the songs they play on the record after. I don't know the names of them even. Life is but a dream. That one.
There's Shake, Rattle, and Roll. Plays over the credits. Yeah, some just kind of like some nice period 1950s music.
So good.
But then so much of the comedy also plays out to silence in this movie. The moment that it stood out to me the most is Scarlett and Colonel Mustard. You go first. No, you go first. And then they both go at the same time and get stuck exiting from behind the bar. Like the comedy plays out to there's enough of a silence within the ambience of the scene itself that that the pin drop silence of it is what elicits the big laugh. It's not underscored with a bunch of music. But again, that's the theatrical side of it that I see in this movie.
Who's the maid with? Is that the maid is with
maid, Colleen Capavette.
Yeah, and with Mr. Green, because everyone wanted to go. Well, all the men wanted to go with Yvette, but then Mr. Green, who's gay coded, gets to go with her and is upset. Why don't you want to go first? Because I'm fighting. I'll be right behind you. That's what I'm afraid of. Exactly. Just a silent moment after that. It's genius.
And it's not, it doesn't have to resort to or how hammy and sweaty the comedy is in this movie, because it is like very, while it is funny, it's like dating back to like 1930s screwball comedy. Like it's very kind of played out, hammy, sort of like, what'd you say, pal? Like that sort of thing. But it's, they never turn at the camera and wink. They never take it that like extra step too far. They have respect for the separation of it and that they all commit to it very hard.
Even that very, one of the very first jokes, I think it is like the first joke is never verbalized, is the dog shit on the bottom. Right. Like Tim Curry walks in to where the maid is setting up and he leaves and she checks her shoe. And then every other person who walks into that room is trying to smell dog shit. But then that's like the end of the joke, but it lives there on its own without any lines.
And also I have an appreciation that in the 1980s, so many classic comedies from the 80s, you know, a lot of them made by the same like small group of people, but they break reality and they go into absurdism and surrealism. I think of movies like Airplane and The Naked Gun, or even Ghostbusters, which is like getting into a paranormal thing with it. This is all very like grounded. There's no special effects craziness. There's no goblins and vampires in this movie. It's kind of, it's low key. And I appreciate a movie that's grounded in some kind of reality, especially when it is this campy, ridiculous throughout.
Totally. That's a good point. I want to, I apologize to the viewers, for the listeners, for all of my impressions. I am a theater kid, but my very favorite parts of the movie.
Okay, are we doing impressions? Here we go.
Are Mrs. White's one-liners. She has these small bits that are just so funny when she's going off about how much she hated her husband. And she's like, flames on the side of my face. Mm-hmm. And then they all just look at her for a second. And then she just gets interrupted and they start running again. Those, I think, are the most genius and just these small parts that are so telling of the genius of Madeleine Kahn's subtle humor.
Yeah, there's a moment in one of the endings there, but yeah, Mr. Green just says something and then she just has a whimper in response. The flames on the side of my face is, I think that's got to be my favorite quote from this movie, which so quotable. Like watching it alone for this show, I don't know if you watched it alone in preparation, but it works better with a crowd. It's like, it is funny, but some of the comedy is so ridiculous that you need other people around to loosen you up and be like, oh, come on, I'm watching Clue. Like, this is funny. It's dog shit. Come on, who doesn't laugh at dog shit?
I mean, I think that kind of goes for any cult film. It's great with your fellow members who stand the movie.
Yeah.
Appreciate it together.
My ex-girlfriend, her family is an annual tradition. I'm sure they're still doing this. This is the Christmas Eve movie in their family. So right before bed on Christmas Eve, they all throw on Clue, drink some eggnog. And then in, I want to say 2016, for my birthday party, I had a screening of Clue for my friends at the Broadway Theater in Saskatoon. So, because it is, it's just a movie that's fun to get together and enjoy and have fun watching.
Did people dress up for dress up?
No, I don't think so. It wasn't compulsory for the party, but maybe someone did.
If anyone is listening, please send me a size 14 Mrs. Peacock replica, and I will forever be your friend.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
So the three multiple endings, what do you feel? I don't buy the endings other than the one where everyone has done one of the murders. I think it undercuts the comedy of like Peacock being so funny and ridiculous the whole movie to think that she actually killed all these people in cold blood.
I disagree. I think that's my favorite ending. Because, for the same reason, it's out of her character a little bit, but like, it gives this empowerment to flighty old ladies where, okay, no, she did it all and she is getting away with it. And she has the gun, she has the power. And like the 10-year-old me that was actually a 60-year-old woman was.
We love to see like a frumpy auntie win. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I can see that. I feel it. I get it.
but I hear you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think my least favorite is when Miss Scarlet did it. But yeah, I don't know why, but it was the least exciting for me.
I think, well, and also, of course, the funniest line in the movie of the, I'm going to go home and have sex with my wife.
Yeah.
That, like, I feel like how funny that line is in comparison to the endings of the other two, which were just shipped out to theaters. Like, I feel like you'd be ripped off if you didn't get to see the funniest, most complex ending. But.
And it's funny how, like, when it was released, that was sort of, like gay acceptance. Today it could probably be pinned as light homophobia, but like in the day that was as good as it gets on screen for gays, I think.
Yeah, in 1985 it was most definitely something, I think.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Exactly.
And I think this movie deserves definite some love for the work of production designer John J. Lloyd. I just wanted to throw that in there. Someone who worked on a lot of movies in this period, like Animal House, Blues Brothers, a lot of work with John Landis, who came up with the story and produced this movie, almost directed it, but then decided not to and directed the movie Spies Like Us instead. Of course, around this time, this was right after John Landis had been involved in the killing of actor Vic Morrow and two child actors on the set of the Twilight Zone movie. So perhaps a movie where a bunch of people were killing each other was not, you know, but he's still stuck on to produce it anyways. So who knows what goes on in the head of John Landis. But, and then I like to do the box office information on this show. So this movie, when it came out in December of 1985, do you care to guess where it placed on its opening weekend at the box office? What number?
Okay. I don't know this number. 1985. Are we doing
Just the position at the box office, just the ranking, not how much money, but
okay. I don't even know how to guess 10th.
This movie opened in 6th place, and it was behind in ascending order here: Rocky IV, Jewel of the Nile, Spies Like Us, the movie that John Landis directed instead of this movie, White Knights, and Santa Claus the Movie. It's, you know, losing to that at Christmas time, it makes sense.
Okay. I'm impressed.
Yeah. Thank you for being on the show, Lenore. It was great raving about Clue with you.
It was my sincere pleasure. I'm so glad I got to do this. And I hope that listeners are inspired and find their new favorite movie.
And is there anything you want to let the listeners know about that they can follow you for, or anything that they can keep up with on social media, anything like that?
My project right now is Precious Puppies. I do an animated series, and you can find it precious_._puppies on Instagram. And season 2 is coming out this year as we speak, so stay tuned and buy a shirt.
Excellent. All right. Thanks for being on the show, Lenore.
Thanks for having me, Zach, and have a great day.
They fly, they squeak, and they are thirsty for blood. But don't worry, Lou Diamond Phillips is on the case.
Wait a second. Are you saying some kind of bat did this?
Bats, Wednesday on City.
And that was Clue. My thanks again to Lenore for being on the show. If you enjoyed the show, you can follow the program on Instagram at formatted2fit. You can email into the show at formatted2fitpod@gmail.com. If you're a new listener and you enjoyed the show, you can check out the back catalog for past episodes such as Something's Gotta Give, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Hereditary. In 2 weeks' time, dear listener, please come back when I will be joined by Chicago-based comic and actor Nick Oldershaw, formerly of the podcasts Doom Scroll and Coward Hour, for a discussion of 1974's The Conversation, written and directed by Francis Ford Coppola. We're getting a new Coppola movie this year, so what better time to dig into one of his classics? And that'll be in 2 weeks, but for now, thanks for listening.